Okay, time once again for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacey. So the big news, Stacey, is that the UK has lost its AAA rating for their debt.
I called it the apocalypse.
Yeah, the apocalypse. And, the pound, the British pound, immediately sold off at a three-year low. This means, of course, for people who own gold and silver, that these will hit new all-time highs against the pound shortly. So once again, the strategy of not having much faith in the government has been paying off.
And I do believe, Max Kaiser, you said on Andrew Neil's Daily Politics show, about a month and a half, 2 months ago, that this would happen, that the UK would be downgraded. This is Moody's that downgraded it. I don't think S&P has yet done it. So they downgraded it from AAA to AAA1.
Yeah, that's right. January 25th, I was on the Daily Politics show. I said the debt will be downgraded. The pound will continue to sell off, and the bonds here in the UK will sell off, meaning that the interest rates will go up. If you have a tracker fund on your mortgage, you will continue to pay more. The interest rates are now in a bear market, so the tracker rates will continue to rise now every year for the next few years.
Well, you know, a lot of people probably aren't too concerned because, you know, unless they travel to Europe or overseas, they won't really notice it, they think. But, you know, the theory is that we want a weaker pound. And David Cameron said this on television, that he doesn't mind. We're not engaged in a currency war, but we don't mind a lower pound because it helps our exports. But as Andrew Neil did tweet a few weeks ago, you know, the pound is down 16% in the past year over many major currencies, and yet exports were only up like 0.1%. So it didn't actually help, and all it's helped is actually inflation.
Right. Well, the trade picture in the UK, most of the trade is through services, not through manufacturing. So as Neil pointed out, they already had a fall in the pound, and it didn't really create any additional exports. And it's just that the UK is not an exporting of manufactured goods economy anymore, so that doesn't really help the picture. It will cause inflation, though. So the price of stuff, you know, the raw materials that go into the economy and the consumer will be paying more. So you will have inflation, you will have a stagnation, and the increase in jobs that they have over the past couple of years, these are swapping the higher paid jobs for lower paid jobs. So the number of jobs has increased, but these are not jobs that are generating any meaningful living standard rises on the upside.
I mean, I guess also, you know, we've watched a program, some news items recently about the price of petrol increasing and everybody being so upset about this. But of course, oil is priced in dollars. So even though you're an oil, you know, a producing nation, you're still importing actually oil, so it doesn't matter. But even the oil you produce is still priced in dollars, so it's good for the guys who are producing it, and the government, I guess their revenues increase a little bit on a declining resource. But again, you know, it's the consumer that's getting, it's a pincer movement, because of course oil prices and petrol prices are always increasing, but so faster than the rate of inflation, they say. And then so are transport costs, like the train, faster than the rate of inflation, they say.
Right. Well, you know, the immediate spin from the corporate media and the mainstream media on this is that, well, economically, we don't see any real connection to the average person. But the average person is paying more for gas than in the UK. It's 136 per liter. The high, all-time high, was something like 146 a liter. It looks like it'll break the all-time high. So the average person, their direct consequence of this loss of credit rating is that the money printing to finance the UK debt has to be increased, which means the price of the purchasing power of your pound decreases, and you see that at the pump. And now 25% of the income of the average person in Britain goes to transportation. So that's a very high percentage of your, it's higher than health. It's the biggest single component of people's expenditure is transportation, higher than health and higher than the other one that they mentioned. But it's this food. Yeah, higher than food, higher than health. It's transportation, and that's directly the result of what we just saw in this downgrade, and that those trends are continuing to work against them.
Now, I see a headline here. I have the Guardian, the Telegraph, and the Daily Mail open, and I see in the Daily Mail, Osborne urged to cut or freeze petrol tax as pump prices soar. Of course, that's not going to do much because it's I think it's something like a 3p a liter rise in tax. But you know, speaking of the taxes, so HMRC, Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, they released a list. It was a big headline all over the place that they were going to name and shame the tax defrauders or evaders, and they posted it on bbc.co.uk. I clicked on the link, read it, and then I saw they had a hyperlink to the actual list. And I almost didn't click on it. I was like, it's probably just going to be a big, giant, long list of tens of thousands of names and all obscure names. Anyway, it was just 9 names. And I kept on downloading the document thinking I had, like, the download hadn't quite worked, and I only got the first page. And it was just 9 names, and they were, like, hairdressers, plumbers, handymen. And this has become a big story because I think people kind of see it as, you know, yet another of these Marie Antoinette sort of moments where just the elite, the governing bodies, the politicians just don't seem to understand how obvious it is that they're protecting the super elite criminals, and forcing 99.9% of the population to pay for all their crimes.
Yeah, the social cohesion is deteriorating. I was just listening to a Mark Faber interview at King World News, and he was making this point that the asset, the capital, you know, the money that's being printed is flowing to capital owners, capital holders, asset holders, and this is causing, you know, remarkable dislocations. And so the anyway, this downgrade is just going to add to this, because the need to continue to print money, and the way that the system goes, I mean, you think of it as an irrigation system, the relationship between the Bank of England and the rest of the economy. You know, they print the money, and it should flow into the fields of the economy in some way to create growth throughout the entire economy. But it's been hijacked by special interest groups, in this case bankers, so that when the Bank of England and the Chancellor get together and they print money, it just goes into a few hands. So you only have growth in a very small percentage of the economy because of this hijacking of the whole irrigation system by those who have destroyed it in a lot of ways. So that is getting worse. So the, you know, we're seeing a rise in political comedy here. We know we've been doing this show for 10 years, and the question always was, will we see in popular culture any reflection of this economic hijacking that's taken place, and will we see it in the music, will we see it in the comedy? And it looks like it's happening in the comedy. We were at a comedy event last week called Lollitics in Camden. So you had 4 or 5 comedians, and they're all political aware. You know, these are the children of the Mark Thomases and the Mark Steeles generation. And they're coming up, and they're political, and there's some a similar activity in the U.S. as well. So culturally, the there is an awareness now, and there is some need to get out there and talk about it. And so that's a change that was coming.
Yeah, well, it was pretty radical stuff actually as well, which was surprising because it sounded like some of the words could have been coming out of Max Kaiser's mouth. That's the first I've seen that in many years and all the years of this crisis. But there was also, I think, Robin Ince, who was one of the first comedians up. He was interesting at setting basically the framework for what we're all operating within, and that is how far right everything has moved since he began in comedy in terms of political discourse on the news and by politicians, whether it's from Labour or Tory, and that he was called in some paper the face of the radical left. And he's saying, here I am, a 44-year-old, kind of little bit liberal, sort of, granola maybe every once in a while, but that's it. And the reason is because in this sort of cultural right-wing space we're in, it's like to be against slavery, for example, is considered radical left, that you're against business because you're against slavery. I mean, it's shifted so far to the right that he is standing there in where he used to be in the middle, but it's now the way, way, way radical left.
Yeah, we've talked about this in the States. We've said that in the States, there's the extreme right, and then there's the maybe not so extreme right, and that's it. There's no center. There's no left. Left. If you're left, you really run the risk of being killed, like an Aaron Swartz, who's you consider him a lefty in America, and the Chris Dodd over at the MPAA killed him. So that's that. Nobody. There's the risk of death if you're on the left in America. So here, in Britain, it's not they're not killing the lefties. They're ostracizing them and they're ignoring them, and that's true. But we think by U.S. standards, you have a vibrant left-wing political wing here in America by U.S. standards. But here in the U.K. They and they've seen over the last 10 years or 15 years a drift where the center has moved, way right. And that's true. I mean, we see that all over the world. You see it in Australia, you see it in Austria, you see it in
Canada.
Canada. These were typically social lefty strongholds, and really they've all gone to the right. Then in Iceland, because they had to reinvent themselves from scratch, they're more progressive. I don't think they're still trying to find, a political footing, but they're progressive, I think you could say, at the very minimum, because they had to be because they collapsed. And but what's coming out of there is interesting politically.
But even they, there was recently a proposal to basically start monitoring the internet in order to ban pornography downloads. So Birgitte Jonsdottir, our friend, she, tweeted me that this w would happen over her dead body because she's not going to allow it if she can help it. But there's a constant right movement. I mean, I think it's probably part of, the US was the last empire that all these Western nations were attached to, and the fate of Australia, the fate of the UK, and the fate of the Canada rely, quite a bit on things staying the same, or at least the power bases there get their subsidies from DC, and they thrive because of these subsidies and because of the US military and because of the propensity of the population to be so stupid not to care what the hell is being, as long as somebody's being killed, they don't care. But it's really about trade wars and monopoly, rights. But, as we see other nations emerging, they're going to be even crazier right wing. So, not only is the political atmosphere here a few years behind the US, but it is moving to the right. You have this sort of situation that you only ever saw in America. You'd hear stories of 5,000 people, 10,000 people lining up outside Walmart for 150 jobs available. Here, you had this past week the Costa Coffee situation where 1,700 people showed up to apply for eight jobs. And now the newspapers are interviewing the eight people that got the jobs. Mm-hmm. So this is a new sort of, you know, Orwellian sort of, you know, weird follow every track of our life. And here's the winners. The other, you know, 1,692 people are losers.
Mm. Yeah, they're celebrated for getting what are, you know, these are not high paying jobs, right? I mean, you're a barista at a coffee shop. It's I think it's a minimum wage job.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Plus, I mean, it's a lot more than what you'd get in the U.S. because the minimum wage is different there. But here, so I guess it's like £8.35, something like that. It's a minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So these are people who have just landed minimum wage jobs, and they're being profiled as celebrities, basically, because there are 1,700 people showed up. Now, those 1,700 people who didn't get their minimum wage jobs, by the way, that minimum wage job will not do anything to pay down Britain's debt, because the tax that the state collects from those minimum wages is not sufficient, along with the other million or so minimum wage or part-time or temporary jobs that were created in the last year, to make a dent in the debt. That's why under the coalition government over the past 2 years, the debt has gone up 60%, and it's rising rapidly. So these jobs, they're celebrities. You know, it doesn't make any economic sense. They're not adding to the economic stability of the country. That it's subsistence working. I mean, a minimum wage job in this country, obviously, if you're in London, you couldn't afford to live in London. You'd have to rent out somebody's, you know, bedroom maybe, or flop on somebody's couch. I mean, you can't.
It's called a bedsit.
You can't rent a flat. So I mean, so now they're in another part of the country. They're in, but even so, you know, this is a minimum wage job. You can't really. There's not much you can do there. It's minimum wage jobs are for people who are just getting out of school for a year or two or 3 years, and then they get jobs that where they can start to raise a family, get jobs, and add to the GDP of the country. But this is not going to help reduce the debt. It does nothing to the GDP. So the standard for a story about business success is so low in the Telegraph these days that they're making celebrities out of seven people who got minimum wage jobs.
Well, yeah. And I mean, even the guy on the front page, he says, I'm going to cling on to this job, because he was out there in the market looking for jobs for a long time. And all the 1,700 people that showed up, a lot of them were college graduates and had been looking for years since graduating from college university with tens of thousands of pounds in debt. And I think the oldest person they hired was 30. Oh, actually, their starting wage is £6.50. So again, I mean, you're talking about the taxes they might pay on that. It's going to be dwarfed by the various welfare and tax credits they receive on the other side for being so low paid. The same thing in America. Remember, all those Walmart jobs are, of course, subsidized by the taxpayer, because they get paid minimum wage, $8 an hour or so in the U.S. And because of that, they collect Medicaid, which is free medical care, and food stamps.
Right. And to, you know, this is a service job. It's not a manufacturing job. They're not going to go to a factory to manufacture something to export. This is why it doesn't matter how cheap the pound gets. It doesn't add to the export business, because all the jobs being created, or most of them being created, are what are called service jobs, and these are seven people who just got service jobs to make coffee. That's not adding to the ability to export anything in the country. And this is what the majority of jobs in the UK are: service jobs. They're lawyers and barristers and stockbrokers and money managers who perform services, but they don't create stuff that can be exported in exchange for other countries' exports in a way that would enhance the wealth of the country. The wealth of the country is draining away.
Yeah. I mean, even listen to this bleak description here. The new Costa in a building that once housed an HSBC bank displays the identikit decorations of the 1,200 branches dotted across Britain. Red awning, fake leather stools, wall prints of cappuccinos. But among its new barristers, there is a sense of wonder at the surroundings. All eight of the successful candidates, Heather Davies, Stephen Tomlinson, Christina Delfino, Christina Harkin, Amy Coring, Cassie Knowles, Harley Clark, and Michaela Sednervo, gathered on Thursday before yesterday's opening. They are aged between 17 and 30, and three are undergraduates. None could believe they had made it. "It's really exciting," said 27-year-old Knowles, the new manager. "We're shocked and can't get over how many people applied. To be one of the successful eight is amazing."
Well, yeah, I don't see what the big deal is. But now, what about the customers? Now, what town is this in?
This is in a good question. This week in Nottingham, the people of Nottingham. They start off this article in the Telegraph saying that this is a modern day tale of two cities, because Totnes in Devon, which is filled with hippies, really, you know, and I guess upper middle class sort of hippies. It issued a call to arms when Costa was going to open a branch there. And there's 6,000 of a population of 8,300 signed the campaign No to Costa campaign. And so Costa Coffee didn't go in there. But here's Nottingham. So it's up just below Sheffield, I guess. And so, yeah, they welcomed it and everybody was racing to get these eight jobs.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, let's what about the customers of these of this shop? Because the product, the coffee, is hyper. It's a luxury. It's considered a luxury product, and people are spending 2 or 3 or 4 pounds for a cup of coffee that you can easily get for 50p, if you wanted to, be more cost efficient at your coffee purchases. So the coffee market has ridden this trend of the small luxury market, where people are they can't afford to trade up, let's say, their house or their car or an education, but they do indulge in overpaying for coffee. So there's this niche market that has given birth to thousands and thousands of coffee shops, because the underlying commodity, coffee, and the spread between the cost of beans and what you can sell the brew is enormous. So the margins in that business are incredibly high. So at some point, though, A, you're going to have a saturation with, opening Starbucks, within Costa's, within Starbucks. You know, at some point, there's a saturation in the market. Number two, at some point, people in this economy are not even going to be wanting to spend on these small luxuries. And McDonald's has entered the business, so they're offering the same coffee for a lot less. So people will probably kind of start to look at that. And so this is not, again, it's not a sustainable business. It's a faddish business. It's not something that is going to create long-term economic health. It seems like a crazy celebration of a very minor event economically. It's not going to change, and it's going to continue the trends as they are. Low paid jobs that are frivolous and meaningless.
You actually came up with a good idea there. I think Starbucks, especially in certain areas in New York City that are super popular, you walk in and there's a line out the door. They should open VIP sections. $20 gets you in, nicer seats, quieter, not all the riffraff, a different separate free Wi-Fi section, which is faster, and its own barista there. So you don't have to wait in those long, huge lines out there with the normal people. They should open a VIP section in some of those chains.
Maybe they will.
It also says the flood of applications to Costa over the past 3 months is attributed in part to the recent collapse of other high street chains. HMV, Clinton Cars, Comet, and Jessup's have all been forced to call in administrators. It is also due to the scarcity of available full-time work, a growing issue with Britain's labor market that has been masked by this week's robust employment figures released by the Office for National Statistics. So according to the employment figures, the rise in total number of employment between last October and December increased so much that now it takes the total number of people in work to almost 30 million, the highest since records began in 1971. But unemployment fell by 14,000 to 2.5 million from the peak of 2.7 million. But they include, economists claim that the job figures are obscured by government training schemes, such as the back to work programs where they force you to work for free at places like Costa. Mm-hmm. They include those people as being employed now. So suddenly, because they have all these slaves all across the UK.
Well, the Poundland story.
Yeah.
Where the woman was forced to work for no pay. But if she refused this slave job, her benefits would be cut. So she would lose her cot in the company shack if she didn't slave on for Poundland. So they include those jobs. So yeah, well, that's pretty sad, isn't it?
Yeah. And so it's forcing economists are now looking at the quality of jobs being created in Britain. As you said at the opening, that they're not manufacturing anything. It's just a service sector job. And this is one thing, actually, that Paul Craig Roberts was one of the first to, I remember like 4 years ago interviewing him. And he kept on talking about, you have to look at the quality of jobs being created. This is the most important thing to look at, because they could talk about job numbers all they want. You need to look at how much they're going to be earning, what sort of stability in the job, what sort of wealth creation on the job. And the Telegraph says almost a quarter, 25% of the current jobs in the labor market are temporary, and more than 8 million are working part-time. So of those 30 million people working, 30 million jobs, 8 million of them are part-time. 1.4 million of them because they cannot find more hours. So 1.4 million want to work more. The three full-time positions among the eight advertised at the Costa Coffee offered exactly what is so scarce in Britain's economy, full-time jobs. So even of those eight jobs, only three of them were full-time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right.
Oh, well, that's the way it is. So what else? You know, by the way, yes, there's been a problem on MaxKaiser.com because, like all of these things, you know, there's various cache sort of plugins in the background to help the site run better, I guess, because of the page load and the traffic load. And, you know, they're constantly updating these things because of various security issues. And the recent update that happened 2 days ago on one of the cache plugins apparently has broken something. So some people can't access the site. I suggest you go through Chrome because I'm able to view it in Chrome, but I do see in Firefox or Safari, you're unable to see MaxKaiser.com. It's like you're able to see it, but the content is stopped updating 2 days ago when this update on the site happened. We're trying to fix it, so don't go too berserk. In the meantime, you could, of course, if you don't feel like going to Chrome, you can go to Twitter, and we will be tweeting links anyway to the current stories, and you could certainly follow those.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's good. Good update for the people on MaxKaiser.com. How's our show doing, the Kaiser Report? That's a good show. Things are happening?
Oh, yeah. Well, we have a really excellent week coming up because you must prepare yourself for this upcoming week. You see, we had in the studio on Friday Professor Antal Faketa, and he's a world-renowned mathematician and a monetary scientist, and he's, you know, quite old, in his late 70s, early 80s, I guess. But wow, what a charming and interesting conversation. It's the first in our 410 episodes now, 411 from, I guess, Monday. 410 episodes, not a single doubleheader interview have we done. This is the first doubleheader, and you could have done at least two more That was so interesting and fascinating. You guys were having a really charming, interesting conversation.
It was very nice, very good. I think people will like this interview. And when's the first one goes on? Monday night, Tuesday morning?
Yep.
And then who's on today's show? We interviewed somebody.
I can't remember. We've been doing a lot of work recently, a lot of good stuff. We'll tell you about it coming up soon, but it's kind of a...
We're going to New York, right? What's going on there?
Yeah, we're going to New York, so we're also going to, pre-record a few interviews because the travel process is so laborious. So this is why also we interviewed Fiketa. By the way, the conversation with him is about gold, silver, backwardation, manipulation, Austrian school. It's wide-ranging stuff for 26 minutes. And then we're going to New York for about 3 weeks. We're going to get caught up in that maelstrom of what's happening on Orphans, because we will be seeing a Broadway play called Orphans with Alec Baldwin, that his co-star dropped out. That's a big shebang.
Oh, yeah.
We'll be talking to Jim Rickards there, Steve Keen. They're both in studio. And we'll also be in Paris for a few days. And that's a very interesting story. We'll hopefully have something to tell about that as well. Interesting meetings there. But I want to go back to what I see on the Guardian front page. And this is a headline called Egypt spent £1.7 million on tear gas amid economic crisis. Activists condemn government's purchase of 140,000 canisters at a time when foreign reserves are at critical low and IMF loan delayed. So this is from just this past month. Egypt spent the equivalent of £1.7 million on 140,000 U.S.-sourced tear gas canisters last month, despite the Egyptian government nearing bankruptcy and amid a wave of police brutality that 21 human rights groups this week labeled a return to Mubarak-era-style state repression. And, of course, this is something you see in revolutions throughout history. The French did this, certainly. The American Revolution, we didn't see much of this, is that, remember, during the uprising in Tahrir Square, is you saw a frequent commentary you saw on the news was the Egyptians with, you know, red watering eyes being interviewed on television saying, you know, we notice that all these tear gas canisters are made in America. And how do you think that makes us feel? Well, of course, they get into power and then they start buying some to throw at their enemies, which are now the other people in Tahrir Square, the ones that we talk to, which are all the liberal class, the educated class, the progressives, the college students. Those guys have been shut out of this new government, and it's all the religious radicals that apparently the U.S. Backs. So there we are, Max.
Mm. Yes. Well, I guess the that whole revolution thing is back to, did it do anything? I guess not.
Well, you know, look at what the French Revolution, it went on for, you know, the post-revolution situation happened for about 20 years of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had Napoleon, and who brought about some stability.
Yeah.
But again, you know, I mean, no, the rest of the world considers him a dictator. Not in France. They still don't consider him a dictator. But,
no, they don't celebrate Robespierre in France, you know. They celebrate the tyrant Napoleon. You know, Robespierre was the guy who brought about the revolution, you know. He's the one who brought about the Reign of Terror. He got rid of all those aristocrats. You know, the whole practice of eating horse meat comes from France when the revolutionaries started eating the horses of the aristocracy after the revolution.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what will happen to these guys. So Robespierre, yeah, he had the ideas, rallied the troops, got all that stuff, but he himself went crazy and started killing all his friends and the fellow revolutionaries. You saw the same thing in the Russian Revolution. You know, the victors became the new torturers and oppressors and repressors. So luckily for us, we lived in an experiment where that didn't happen. Not until today. It was a delayed response. And this is what you see. I mean, who knows? Because, you know, you see the same thing in Tunisia, for example, same thing happening there. So the religious groups, the Muslim Brotherhood, remember, they were allowed a certain voice. They were much more organized. They were the only official opposition party under Mubarak, for example, in Egypt. So they had organizing skills and already political apparatus in place to take over power, where all the other progressive groups were split amongst each other on various issues and whether, you know, education or climate change or tax reform or things like that. And they all split and divided amongst each other, whereas this one monolithic, you know, Muslim Brotherhood was able to swoop in. But now there's a lot of protests and violence and violent protests happening again in Tahrir Square and in Tunisia, where the same a similar thing happened. What do you think about Tunisia, Max? Because it's now emerged exactly as we we predicted, everybody said at the time, which was that Ben Ali stole all the gold from the Tunisians with the help of Sarkozy and his complicit cadre of police and intelligence services, I guess, through they laundered it all through French airports.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Gold is preferable, you know, because it maintains its purchasing power. So it makes sense that they would traffic in gold. You know what else has maintained its purchasing power is Bitcoin. I see Bitcoin hit a new all-time high. It's over $31 conversion rate for Bitcoin. And see, Bitcoin, unlike gold and silver, you can't manipulate it. So I think, you know, Bitcoin is giving us a price signal of a currency other than the fiat currencies around the world and gold and silver, which are all heavily managed. Bitcoin is the only true free market currency in the world right now, and it shows that that kind of thing is trading at a premium. So this is really emerging as the only real valid, viable currency around the world now is Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, I still have mine, which I got at $2. I'm a Bitcoin.
Well, people are using it. You know, the technology is proliferating. More and more retailers are using it. And it's a cryptocurrency. I see Mega over there in New Zealand is going to start using it, and they're totally encrypted and online storage and cryptologically protected. So there's this parallel economy and internet emerging, which is, cryptologically protected. Which is in response to the dead hand of the market, which is forcing people underground and into the Bitcoin world.
I visually pictured people underground, like an underground railroad or a network of revolutionaries. So let's go to Bloomberg.com and see what's over there, see if there's anything interesting on there. You know, we'll also be talking to Dominic Frisby coming up. Pierre Jovanovic will be interviewed soon. Eric Hilton of Thievery Corporation. That's an interesting story. Did you want to tell that or should I?
Tell the people.
Well, so, you know, we get thousands of emails every week, to tell you the truth, on kaiserreport@rttv.ru. And there are so many, and we're so busy, and it's hard to actually read them all. So basically, there were like 15,000 emails that I hadn't read. And I was going through them. And, you know, a lot of it is also spam or junk mail or just, frankly, completely insane people. Deleting, and I found some that had been, I found in a spam folder also a bunch of these weird old ones, and Eric Hilton of Thievery Corporation from a year ago, it was exactly a year ago, January 2012, had emailed us, had emailed you because you had spoken about copyright on, obviously, on Kaiser Report, and he wrote a very long, thoughtful email about how, you know, he's a fan of the show. He watches the show all the time, but he agrees with a lot of the stuff you say, but he disagrees on copyright because he's a musician and he's been trying to sell his work. Everybody downloads it for free instead. And therefore, he wanted to debate you about this topic. So we'll be speaking to him soon about that. He's in Washington, D.C., and they've got some really great stuff out. Go, you know, search for them on YouTube, check out their stuff, and their latest stuff is really quite radical as well. So it's really good stuff. I always listen to them, so I was really excited to get some.
Yeah, the music industry is split on this. You know, a lot of musicians don't believe in the copyright system. A lot of musicians do believe in the copyright system. You know, this is both, I guess the guy at Foo Fighters or one of those ex-Nirvana guys was saying that, you know, he doesn't believe in the copyright system. And so, you know, on this issue, the thing about copyright and intellectual property is that there is no recorded chain of ownership. So you don't really know. It's not like a piece of land where you can say, this land has been owned by this person today, and it was owned by this guy beforehand, and you can track it back 100 years or 1,000 years. With music and other intellectual property, you don't really know who the owner is. You don't know. You don't know where it came from. It's part of the the commonwealth. So there is no such thing as private ownership of ideas and music and intellectual property. So, and unfortunately, copyright, which provided a limited time of monopoly pricing power, has, because it's, the corporations got a hold of it, in particular Disney, and they've turned it into perpetual copyright, they've killed the golden goose. You know, they're the ones who shot themselves in the foot by going for these copyright extension laws every 20 years. So now they've made copyright law unusable, and it's don't even pay it any attention. It's stupid. So so now the only recourse is to just completely ignore it. And as far as artists go, I mean, they should understand that this is the way you can't claim ownership of an idea. It just doesn't work for it. So it doesn't. It doesn't fit. So I don't know what he's whinging on about, really.
Well, I look forward to that debate. I've already got it all sorted out. It's going to be a good one. And actually, the way you were describing that made me realize that what global bankers and derivatives wielders and financializers have created in America is a form of communism then via their hyper-financialization. In that, you know, you were talking about the chain of ownership in property, but we've lost that in the last few years. They were churning so fast and financializing so fast that nobody knows where any of the contracts are anymore on great swathes of property across the U.S. Mm-hmm. So this is why we had that, you know, that $25 billion mortgage fraud settlement from Obama for all the 50 states and the top five banks, is that they didn't want this to have to go to court and therefore in a court of law see that there was no ownership for lots of these properties. Nobody knows where the contracts are anymore.
Yeah. So similarly in copyright, you really can't say who owns the ideas. So but they, in the banking law, they indemnified everyone. They gave everyone immunity and said, "Well, it's too messy. We can't figure it out, so everyone's innocent." You know, so just like in the UK, where they had that trial where the jury wasn't capable of understanding the instructions from the judge. They didn't have they had a mental deficit, as the judge called it, to understand a concept like beyond reasonable doubt. Or they ask a question like, well, can we base our judgment based on something we didn't hear in the trial? Things like that. So the judge was saying, look, you suffer from a deficit of comprehension. It was a busted trial. It was So similarly, you know, same thing in the financial world. There's no chain of ownership, so it's just all a kind of a guesswork that somehow always magically enriches the people who are doing the criminal activities. And in copyright, there is no chain of ownership, and there should be no law at all to begin with. But here, where it's clearly no reason to have an ownership law, you do have like the NDAA and or not the or the MPAA and the RIAA, who are going after people in a ridiculous way and putting them in prison and prosecuting them, and in the case that we mentioned, killing them to defend something that's indefensible.
That whole trial, that the jury that had to be dismissed because they had a deficit of understanding of very, very simple English words, as the judge said, like they are the actual foundation words. There's no lower than that to try to explain it to you of what the concepts are you're trying to ask me.
Right, to explain what reasonable doubt is, he had to say, well, it's having doubt that you find would be reasonable. So there's no way I can break that down anymore. You know, that's it. That's the concept. If you don't get that concept, then I have to call this a mistrial, because you're too stupid to be a jurist, is what he was saying.
And then he also said, well, a question was asked, can we use evidence that hasn't been presented?
Yeah, can we eat our own toe jam and vomit up a verdict? Will that suffice?
But of course, you know, we were talking about these revolutions and failed experiments, and the one successful one, for briefly anyway, was the American Revolution. And when Ben Franklin emerged from this Continental Congress, or the Constitutional Congress thing, when they were creating the Constitution, a woman on the street allegedly asked him, what do we have? And he said, well, you have a republic, if you can keep it. Mm-hmm. And a republic, of course, is different from a democracy. It's a rule of law. It's a foundation on law. And here we're showing that we have not been able to keep it, because we've become too stupid to even understand the basic concepts of law.
Mm. Right. Well, the other way to look at it is that the idea of a jury trial is to be a jury of your peers.
Yeah.
So the fact is that over the past 20 years, people are the peer group is stupider. So I don't. They're not going to find any smarter juries, because through the dumbing down, the drugs, the horse meat, you know, the all the other problems, the poverty, has the average peer group for a jury pool is now a lot stupider than it was 10 years ago. So these are your peers. So justice becomes more of a flip of a coin. It depends, you know, if somebody, it becomes like the Inquisition. It's just about guys. Speaking of the Inquisition, so there's a lot more scuttlebutt emerging regarding the Pope's departure from the Vatican. Have you been following that?
Well, okay. He did used to head the office of the Inquisition. He's stepped down suddenly. My family's Catholic. They seemed a bit shocked from what I could tell on Facebook. But it's pretty bizarre, these new faces emerging. So first of all, one of the front runners is this guy, this African guy, Peter Thurston. And that's pretty weird, just because according to the papal prophecies that were written back in like 1127, It was Saint Malachi. He predicted all the popes up until the current one, and then from the current one there would be one more, and it would be Pope Peter, and of Rome, and he would be the last. Rome would end. So it could all be over soon, guys. You know, maybe these meteorites and asteroids flying around is a sign of something coming, and. But the interesting thing to me is, like, this Scottish cardinal, where he was saying, like, all these weird reformers suddenly coming out, and they want to allow priests to marry. So that would be the first time in, like, 1,500 years or 1,400 years. Remember, it was the popes back in the day, they used to have all sorts of mistresses and families, and the cardinals did too. And one of the reasons that it was introduced that priests had to be celibate. To the public, it was that, you know, they could only be loyal to God and faithful to God. Well, in reality, what it was that none of the popes, because you obviously you ran the Vatican Bank, you became a very powerful land-rich guy, they didn't want any rival clans. So these cardinals would have these sons, and they would build up and get people allied to them and have all sorts of allegiances to each other, and they build up an empire and they could rival the Pope. Mm-hmm. So basically they didn't want that to be able to happen. And so therefore, even if they had children, they were now completely illegitimate according to the Catholic Church.
Yeah, it's voluntary sterilization to make sure you don't breed any powerful offspring that would challenge the current power structure. So it's nothing to do with getting your wee-wee wet.
But that's a nice way to put it. But now there are people, cardinals, who are going on their way to Rome right now to go, or Vatican City, to go vote for the next pope. And they're saying, you know, they want to change this law and go back to just allowing priests to marry. Of course, it would, you know, doing so would return it to how it started, but also would get rid of these, you know, people with problems with their own sexuality and therefore like psychological problems attracted to the church as some weird sort of, you know, way to try to deal with their own sexuality.
Well, of the three desert religions, as they're called, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, it seems like, you know, you look at Judaism and the rabbi, you know, this seems to be organic to the nature of a community. You know, there's the rabbi, who is a guy who reads books all day long and gives advice on things. But he's not holding himself up to be, you know, as the other two religions seem to get a little carried away in their communication with the higher powers. You know, the rabbis in this particular grouping of religions, you know, at least they just seem to be more like, go talk to the rabbi. You know, he's a fixer. You know, there's more of a role for this. But these other ones, it's so crazy. But with the Pope, though, that there's now apparently a blackmail scandal that's at the root of his abdication of his papacy that's emerging.
Oh, I haven't seen this, but it would make sense. Is it about the sex abuse scandals?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So this is what the latest is. So it would seem at the first spinning of this was that he's making way for a new generation, or they put a pretty positive spin on things. But it just seems that, you know, power mad people don't willfully give away power. I mean, that's not in their character. That's not that's not the shtick, is it? I mean, these are people jockeying for position in a very Machiavellian way to get maximum power. So there must, you know, I mean, there's got to be something.
Well, according to New York Magazine yesterday, gay Vatican blackmail might have pushed the Pope out. The Italian newspaper La Repubblica isn't buying that a Pope resigned for the first time in more than 600 years simply because he wasn't feeling so spry anymore. Instead, a new report points to a juicy-sounding secret dossier, two volumes of almost 300 pages bound in red, involving a faction in the Vatican united by sexual orientation, according to The Guardian. Those officials were supposedly subject to external influence from outsiders with whom they had connected in a, quote, worldly nature, a.k.a. blackmail. The information is thought to stem from an investigation into the VataLeaks scandal in which Pope Benedict's butler, Paolo Gabriele, was arrested for stealing and leaking gossipy Vatican documents. The Pope reportedly received the information on December 17th, the day he decided to step down. According to La Repubblica source, everything revolves around the non-observance of the sixth and seventh commandments, thou shalt not steal and thou shalt not commit adultery. Haaretz notes that the Italian paper in question has a history of exposing homosexual happenings in the Vatican. If the whole thing sounds a bit outlandish, it's worth noting that the Pope's spokesperson opted to neither confirm nor deny the report. The dossier, which will appear soon in a bunch of bad religious mystery novels, is reportedly being held in a safe and will be delivered to Benedict's successor, who we imagine will drop it dramatically in a fireplace and whisper, "We shall never speak of this again."
Yeah, it's interesting that I was reading something where they violated with the sixth and the seventh which is code in that group of Vatican followers for homosexuality, because they don't mention homosexuality directly. They just said it's an adultery and wealth possessions violation, which apparently throughout the ages, when you combine those two, it's code for homosexuality.
Well, however, maybe this is all a good sign of a revolution. You know, as Andrew Sullivan said, this is the most radical act a pope has done in 600 years, and it changes everything. But maybe it does change it this way, because in the world of social media that we have now, it's impossible for them to keep these secrets. All their, you know, they have had secret sort of sex lives and all sorts of stuff happening. But the press that whatever did exist back then was very, obedient to not printing anything.
He stopped tweeting. He closed his Twitter account. That was the biggest news so far.
But that was a sign. This is the social media days. It was a sign. But it also means, like this Scottish cardinal, he's signaling what the actual conversation happening within the elite circles is. We've got to allow sex because we're going to be hit by sex scandal after sex scandal.
Okay, Pope doesn't represent a moral authority, because he can't. They're not celibate. They're having a lot of problems. It's this huge scandal of pedophilia in the church. So if they're not a moral authority, then what are they? Now, they get back to my rabbi idea. The rabbi is a guy who reads a lot, and he'll give you his opinion on things based on the fact that he's just all day long. He weighs these things, and he'll give you his opinion. Okay, there's some value to that. But what value is the priest? The celibacy thing is a joke. That's not, and they've taken away their moral authority. So if they don't have any moral authority, what do you have? What exactly are they doing? Okay, you go through some ritual. You have the baptism and the other ritualistic acts that don't really add up to anything if you have no moral authority. So what's left? I don't know what's left. What is the point? It seems like it may have burnt out.
I don't think so. You know, there's lots of people in the world who love giving their money.
It becomes a cargo cult. It becomes a cargo cult, like we covered before. People do their ritual. No, I'm just saying, and these rabbis, they have some value. They give you their opinion based on the fact that they are opinionated, well-read guys.
Well, maybe the ones you saw in New York, but, you know, from what I can tell and what I've read about what's in Israel is that there are some very radical rabbis happening, radically right and radically, you know, just as crazy as some of these other guys. But that's about it.
But they don't pretend. You know, I just don't see what the point of that. They've lost their moral authority, and so they've lost it. They it took Jesus, you know, to a few years to
I'm
create.
Fade out.
All right.
Okay. Bye.
Goodbye.